Hello there. This is David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Thank you for tuning in to Alternative Realities, a podcast that we launched in August of 2024 and which has already gained a significant following among institutional investors, financial advisors, and individual investors. I'm excited to announce that going forward, Aaron Mulvihill, our US-based global strategist focused on alternative investments, will be the new host of Alternative Realities. With a wealth of experience in the alternative space, Aaron is already the lead author of our Guide to Alternatives, and we believe that Alternative Realities is a natural complement to the guide by facilitating engaging discussions on the diverse world of alternative investments with our guests. If you want to hear more about Aaron, be sure to listen to the conversation we had on our podcast earlier this year, linked to the show notes. And with that, over to you, Aaron.
Thanks, David. I'm very glad to be here. Welcome to Alternative Realities. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, Global Market Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Private credit has grown significantly over the past decade and now accounts for over $1.5 trillion in assets. As traditional bank lending has faced increased regulation, private credit lenders have emerged as a competitive alternative for financing. And for investors, private credit has offered not only compelling returns, but also a diverse array of strategies. Many investors today are using private credit as a complement to traditional fixed income in portfolios. Joining me to talk about private credit and the latest trends for investors is Lynette Ferguson. Lynette is the Global Co-Head of Investment Specialists for JP Morgan Asset Management and also sits in that group's investment committees. Lynette has substantial investment experience in private credit, so I'm really glad she could make the time to be with us today. We'll talk about the growth of private credit, the benefit it brings to borrowers as well as investors. We'll consider what investing looks like in the current market environment, the interplay between private credit and private equity, and how asset-backed lending and other trends are gaining popularity in the space. Lots to get into, so let's get started. Lynette, thank you so much for joining us here today. Before we jump in, can you give us some background on your role and your career here at JP Morgan Asset Management?
Sure. So I started out my career researching and investing into hedge funds, and that was actually primarily on the credit side, and did that for sort of nearly half my career, and ended up being an investor through 2008, also was an investor through the 2008 financial crisis, which was certainly an interesting time to be an investor. Sure. After that, I actually went to work for a credit relative value hedge fund, and that was here at JP Morgan, before moving to work for a private debt special situations fund that was a startup private credit fund where I ran the non-investment side of the business and also sat on the fund's investment committee. From that, I sort of basically came into this role. So this has really sort of pulled together all the different parts of my career so far. So here I sit both in a client-facing role by being the co-head of our investment specialist team, and I also sit on our investment committees for the Private Credit Solutions Group. This group, I should say, so we invest on a primary, secondary, and co-investment basis into external private credit managers. And we do that across all areas of private credit.
And private credit, it's a relatively new asset class, right? And just to give our listeners and viewers some background on how private credit operates, maybe we split it into sort of the lenders and the borrowers to make it simple. If we start with the borrowers, what type of borrowers use private credit and how does it compare to traditional bank lending, for example?
So private credit's been around for a long time. And actually people tend to think of private credit as really growing just post the 2008 financial crisis, where a lot of bank regulation came in and made it less attractive for banks to lend. And so you saw then banks stepping out and then private funds stepping in to fill that lending gap. It's really been going for a lot longer than that. So back from the 1970s, when you had increased securitization came in, and then you had the levered loan market in the 1990s and early 2000s, before you sort of had the current move and explosion in terms of private debt provision. So then sort of stepping into who the borrowers are. So from a borrower perspective, it's as banks have pulled back, essentially private credit's first role has been to provide credit to those borrowers who can't access the broader, either public markets or the bank lending markets. And it might be those borrowers are, it might be that they're too small. It might be that the needs are too complex for banks and in terms of what banks are sort of trying to do. And so that might be the first stage in terms of borrowers who can't access it. The other side I would say is that from a, in terms of the types of borrowers, I think people have often thought that direct lending has historically been the biggest part of it has been the direct lending, which has been essentially lending to companies. And so people have used those terms interchangeably. And so direct lending has often been sort of seen as synonymous with private credit, whereas actually the private credit market is much broader than that. So you don't just have lending to corporates, you might have lending to consumers, you might have lending to kind of companies, but rather against their general cash flows. It might be sort of real estate backed or sort of asset backed credit in general, sort of equipment financing or sort of a residential mortgage backed credit. So there's all different areas of private credit. And all these areas, when I say that direct lending has dominated, these other areas have been growing considerably in recent years.
Okay, so it started maybe with more direct lending, and that continues to be the biggest part, but it's expanded into all these other areas as other strategies have emerged.
Yes, and maybe also to comment that you've had two drivers behind the growth of the private credit market. One has been this incentive for banks to lend less. The other has been in terms of private equity and the growth of that market, where a lot of the LBOs and that sort of growth in private equity, you think of that over really sort of the last 20 years or so, a lot of that growth has actually been funded by private debt borrowing. And so there, in terms of the borrowers, you've got a lot of those private equity sponsors have been a key driver of the growth of the private credit market also.
Okay, so there's an interlink there between private equity and private credit.
Yes.
And so then for the lenders or the investors, I suppose, what's the appeal of private credit from an investor perspective, and how can we understand the growth over the last couple of decades?
So in terms of the lenders, so you obviously have in the private credit markets, you have a premium versus public market. So, I mean, that's certainly something we should comment on. And so generally that premium, I would say, has been around 150 to 200 basis points. Additional return that in lenders are therefore able to get through the private debt markets than they are through the public markets. You also have great things like greater customization. So if we look at the broadly syndicated loan markets these days, a lot of that's become so competitive that you have a lot of the covenants, the financial covenants that you would have, and they would do things from either limiting the amount of borrowing that a company can maybe take on, to also sort of maybe limiting, you know, what additional borrowing can be taken on relative to what's already there. So if you're already a borrower, you don't want a company to take on debt that's more senior to you and therefore actually kind of push you into sort of further down in terms of priority if there's debts being sort of paid out. So that those kind of covenants are important, but actually you don't tend to see them as much in the broadly syndicated loan market these days. They've pretty much gone. On the private credit side, that ability to customize actually means important things like you have are more likely to have greater covenants there. I say more likely because the larger end of that market tends to be more competitive with the broadly syndicated loan market. And so as they're more interchangeable, you have seen a weakening in covenants there. But more broadly across the private credit market, so sort of thinking smaller companies, then you're actually kind of seeing those covenants are very much still there. But that customization also, there's other parts that they can kind of put in from a lender's perspective. And that works from a borrower's perspective also. That customization is an advantage on both sides. For lenders also, and actually this works both from a lender and a borrower perspective, if you're looking at public debt, more broadly syndicated debt, then you've got a large pool of borrowers. So a bank might kind of go out and there might end up being sort of 15 to 20 lenders you could see in a single transaction. On the private debt side, you've got a much smaller number. It might only be a single lender, or you might have maybe sort of, you know, maybe kind of 1 to 5 different lenders who might be involved. That smaller group makes it much easier on both sides. And so for the lenders, in terms of who they're working with, if they're trying to get different provisions agreed. So often you tend to have, once you've actually had the initial loan set up, then often there might be, you know, kind of issues might tend to appear maybe kind of 3-4 years down the line. And so you're then having to go out to a different group of borrowers, because that borrower group might change when you're kind of dealing with a broadly syndicated loan. But actually who else you're working with to try and get agreement in terms of agreeing terms with the company. And from the company's perspective, or another borrower's perspective, it will be also the ease of being able to actually kind of get maybe a waiver of a covenant agreed, or maybe kind of get some additional borrowing agreed. And so having that small group makes it much easier to work with. From a lender's perspective also, they're much more likely to have then greater transparency and contact with the company on an ongoing basis. And so it's much easier for them to see more quickly if there are problems that are beginning to occur.
So it's a more negotiable instrument than some of the broadly syndicated loan market or others.
Exactly.
For investors. Okay. And the yield pickup is nice as well, of course, in terms of driving its attractiveness. And, you know, we'll probably come back to regulation a little bit later in terms of what more recent regulation might imply. But going back to kind of covenants, this renegotiation that you touched on, I know you spent some time in the private credit space, in the hedge fund space during the global financial crisis. Could you give us a bit of insight into kind of what was that like? What kind of lessons do you learn that you can apply today?
I mean, certainly it was certainly a great learning period, the 2008 financial crisis, and going through it as an investor. I think there were sort of two areas, I think, where investors and, you know, funds, I think, also learned lessons. One was in terms of the sort of the financing of transactions and also matching the terms of a fund to the underlying investments. And so there you had a lot of hedge funds that maybe had sort of 60-day liquidity, investing into at times very illiquid credit assets. And so it might be illiquid because of the types of strategies they were running, or simply just because that, you know, these were not loans that were, you know, widely traded. It was one of the reasons why you actually saw a number of hedge funds sort of moving into the private credit side after the 2008 crisis, when they learned that that mismatch in terms was a huge problem. It was also important in terms of working out who you were interacting with. So from an investor's perspective, what were the managers like that you were actually investing with? And, you know, people went through, you'd go through their strategies, you'd think you understand what was going on, but who was the actual person that you were dealing with? And sometimes you might look at a lender and see, or sort of look at a manager and see how they're reacting maybe with other counterparties in the market, and they might be aggressive with those counterparties. And in 2008, you could see that with a manager with their back up against a wall, you could see that turn then on their investors. And so we saw some managers who behaved pretty badly. You know, you kind of saw side pockets being created, like investors being blocked from taking money out of funds, regardless of what terms were. You even saw some managers who ended up suing that their investors. So you saw a lot of different types of behavior. And so really that sort of understanding what, you know, who the personalities were that you were dealing with actually became much more important. So references and things like that of how people treated people in the markets more broadly, I think that was a lesson in terms of their importance going forward. But that sort of the financing actually, I would say, led to an increase on the private credit side also, but also then in terms of looking at how the managers themselves are financing transactions. So if they had leverage, making sure that the terms of those leverage matched the terms of the instruments, and that the terms couldn't be changed at short notice. We saw a lot of that in 2008.
Okay, love hearing those war stories from the financial crisis in those times. And that's a dynamic you don't see as much in, let's say, the high yield market or broadly syndicated loan market, that direct kind of negotiation. So are relationships important in private credit?
The relationships are incredibly important in private credit. So you have, in terms of I talked a little bit about 2008, when it was that the investors understanding the companies they were working with. And certainly that manager selection is important. But from a relationship perspective, I would say that between the borrower and lender is incredibly important. So there's sort of different elements of this. You know, I talked a little bit before about, you would often have issues that might occur, say, you know, 3-4 years down the line with a company. And so that relationship between a lender and the company can help decide whether, you know, that company is able to get additional borrowing, whether they're able to get covenants waived. And so that kind of relationship that's built up over time is incredibly important from that perspective. Also sort of working, if you have a private equity sponsor involved, there might be kind of questions around yes, there's a question about whether a private equity company might inject capital into a company if they have a problem, but also in terms of behavior around if things go wrong. And so this sort of feeds into the questions around, you know, the level of covenants and restrictions that you have in a loan, and the amount of protections that there are for an investor. We have sometimes seen that as covenants have gotten weaker, you see bad behavior from some actors in the market. So you might see companies or private equity sponsors that are moving assets out of a company, or they're moving effectively kind of collateral away from where way for my lenders to get access to it. And you might also see them bringing in other lenders. And so effectively priming, also basically kind of bringing in debt that's ahead of the lenders who are already there. So as a lender from your perspective, that is a really bad situation to be in, because all of a sudden you've got somebody else who's got priority ahead of you. If something goes wrong and actually kind of the company starts sort of paying people out, then you're all of a sudden lower down in that prioritization queue. So these things all feed into understanding who you're working with, what people's reputation is in the market, how they behaved in other deals. And so those relationships from that perspective are very important. They're also important on the other side from an origination perspective. So that originating loans is also hugely important. And so it's something that people sometimes underestimate in the private credit world, is that for the ability for lenders to be able to kind of go out and originate debt. And so their relationships, whether it be with private equity sponsors or, you know, kind of with companies generally in the market, with different service providers, and so able to kind of originate different types of loans, particularly when you might be saying no to a lot of those loans, being able to maintain relationships so that despite that you're still able to get access to future deals going forward is also incredibly important.
Yes, it's really interesting, because you sometimes think of these arrangements as very transactional, but actually there's a pattern to them, right? You need to be a good judge of character and understand the institutions and the people you're dealing with. So thinking about just in terms of dynamics of interest rates, right? We have interest rates coming down now, maybe not as fast as we would have thought at maybe 6 months ago. What's the interplay between interest rates and private credit in terms of affecting returns and so on? How do you look at interest rates, and particularly in the environment that we are in now, where we may be seeing interest rates be higher somewhat for longer, but eventually coming down?
So I think one of the key things to understand with private credit is that most of the debt in the private credit market is actually floating rate. And so as interest rates, you know, whatever the move be in interest rates, whether it's kind of going up or coming down, actually feeds directly into private credit returns. So what you're typically seeing is a lending of a spread over what would be, so SOFR is sort of the lending rate that you see in most private credit transactions. So from that perspective, it feeds straight through into the returns. And so you have sort of less, it sort of feeds directly into the returns. I would say in terms of rates at the moment, though rates have sort of been high, and that's mainly come from the increase in base rates, if anything you've seen in terms of credit spreads actually haven't widened out as much as you may have expected. And so credit spreads at the moment are actually sort of on the relatively tight side. And so it's sort of a lot of the increase in return that's come through has actually come from the increase in base rates themselves. So we'd expect private credit returns to persist. So even as base rates sort of begin to come down, we'd expect that the total return to private credit investors, we'd expect to kind of stay persistent kind of going forward.
So credit quality, of course, is a driving factor. We're seeing some softer economic data come through. If we do enter a more challenging economic environment, how does that affect the private credit market?
So I think what's interesting, if we look at the private credit market, we've seen a lot of the growth of the private credit market in what has been a relatively benign economic environment. You know, even if we look back through COVID, that period of stress for markets was actually not that prolonged, because the level of government support that came in, the level and volume of and speed of government support that came in. And so if you're looking at terms of distress, for a lot of people in the market, there's a lot of actors who haven't necessarily seen a stressed and prolonged downturn or recession. And so whereas historically, I think it was actually quite easy to invest into private credit and really just get returns from the beta in the market, I think going forward, there's going to be much more importance in terms of manager selection. So there'll be differentiation between managers in terms of how they perform. So if we have interest rates staying higher for longer, we sort of have a general weakness that we see in economy, that, as you would expect, will make it more challenging for lenders of all types, whether it be consumers or corporates. And you would therefore expect default rates to increase. Or even if you didn't have absolute default rates increasing, you would expect people to be having more issues around loans. We might see more amendments to loans, sort of extensions in terms of borrowing terms.
Okay.
Yeah. And lenders' ability to be able to deal with that will dictate investors' returns. And so you can have very different experiences according to the manager that you're working with, according to the general partner, as to what they're able to do as to what they're able to negotiate with borrowers. So for instance, if you have quite weak covenants, so quite weak protections in a loan, and then actually it's just going to be easier. It might take longer for a company then to default, and then potentially there's less from a recovery perspective for a lender. Or it just might be that maybe you see increasing people refer to it as creditor on creditor violence, where you're actually able to see the weakness of covenants is also allowing maybe kind of priming of debt, as we talked about earlier. And so we're kind of seeing things like, you know, assets being taken out of the range of lenders. And so all of it is ending and equaling a worse outcome for lenders.
Okay. So that's what might drive the dispersion in outcomes is the kind of back to the relationships question and the capability of managers to deal with these situations and deal with their counterparties.
Yes, and just that experience of managers in dealing with workouts. And so you'll have managers who simply haven't had a lot of experience of distress, of distressed debt, of dealing with workouts, of dealing with companies that have had problems. So when you're kind of looking at a manager today, so looking at managers who, for example, have had experience in, maybe they're not just exposed to, not just lending out senior debt, maybe they're also lending out mezzanine debt as well, so more, you know, junior subordinated debt. That means they're much more likely to have had some experience of defaults of companies missing payments, and therefore what to do in those circumstances. And so that means that if you have more distress now, at least they've been able to flex those muscles, whereas somebody who hasn't doesn't have that experience. So it sort of ties into, you know, do they understand the documentation? What is their experience in terms of dealing with workouts? How long has the team worked together? Have they seen other distress periods before? So all those factors become incredibly important when you're working with managers. And so hence that manager selection becomes much more important than it did in a very benign environment.
Okay. Yeah, something to keep in mind when diligencing managers right now. And of course, we're seeing the softer economic data, mostly in surveys. It hasn't come through in the hard data, but it's good to know you're watching these metrics very closely.
Yes, I mean, that's something that we've always done when we've been selecting managers, is making sure that we're careful in terms of who we select so they do have that experience. So our investors will be better protected if there is a downturn.
Okay. And coming back to deregulation that we touched on before, there's been a lot of discussion of deregulation potentially from the current administration. Is this something that you think will impact the private credit industry? How do you view this?
So it's in terms of the current administration, at the moment it's sort of hard to, you know, we wouldn't want to kind of comment on or sort of speculate on regulations that have not been announced, or sort of like changes in regulations that have not been announced. But it's certainly an area that we will, you know, will stay very focused on, so that when announcements are made, we're able to sort of explain to our investors how that might impact the markets that we invest in. It's also important, just in terms of current regulation at the moment, to note that, you know, globally, so in the US, it's referred to as the Basel III endgame. In Europe, for instance, it's referred to as Basel IV, but these are banking regulations which actually continue the trend that we've been seeing since 2008, of a tightening regulations around banks and of incentivizing them to, you know, to be much more, you know, kind of careful and restrictive in terms of the lending that they're doing. Those regulations themselves will continue to make it more attract, you know, continue to create opportunity for private lenders to step in. So, you know, regardless in a way of what the current administration does, they should be, you know, maybe not saying regardless what the current administration does, but so we expect there to continue to be forces sort of globally that will continue to mean that there'll be lots of opportunities on the private credit side.
Okay, so that mega trend is still pushing capital towards private credit over the long term. And talking about the other trend that's driving private credit growth and has been driving growth over the last several years, private equity deal making, and that's slowed down over the last couple of years anyway, since 2022. How do you see how is that impacting the private credit market? Is the lack of deals a challenge? How are you viewing this right now?
Certainly the level of deal making on the private equity side does have an impact in terms of private credit. And we sort of see that sort of feeding into, you know, the private equity aren't doing deals, then they're not demanding private debt to help fund those deals. Because that slowdown has been going on for a while now, we are sort of seeing some companies have been waiting for that, then still sort of trying to get some M&A done. So you're sort of seeing that happening in the markets. We're also seeing, I mean, I think, you know, everybody was predicting coming into this year that we would see a big increase in M&A and an uptick in terms of deal making. I'd say that's not, we haven't sort of seen that yet coming into 2025. I think there's a lot of people who are maybe more cautious in terms of just trying to sort of figure out what the regulation is going to look like going forward, what, you know, economic policy is going to look like going forward. And that has maybe sort of made people pause in terms of deal making somewhat. But on the other side, there's also expected to be, depending on the current administration's view around, say, the SEC and how aggressive the SEC might be in terms of deals. It's, I think generally there's a perception that it'll be an easier environment for deal making going forward. And that is expected also to lead to an uptick in terms of private equity deal making. I should say also that, you know, it's a, you know, we've talked very much in terms of the direct lendings of the kind of corporate side of private credit. And what's also a huge factor this year kind of going forward, and I think will be in the future, is the growth of private credit beyond just direct lending. And so we're sort of seeing from a, you know, people talk, there's, you know, opportunistic credits. We see, you know, asset-backed lending, which could be financial, it could be hard assets. And by financial, I'm sort of talking about things like, you know, consumer loans or mortgages, essentially sort of like financial instruments that will be backing a loan. Whereas on the hard asset side, you might have real estate, you might have infrastructure, you might have equipment. And so all these are areas where actually still the prevalence of private lenders in those markets isn't as big as, say, you might see in the corporate side. And so, but we expect to see those also areas where the private credit market will continue to grow. And so this is, it's not just be in terms of private equity deal making, which will sort of be dictating private credit, even though that's probably the largest part of the market.
Okay, great to see that creativity and stepping out into other areas. And just to wrap up our conversation, Lynette, what are some of the areas that you're most excited about now in terms of growth in private credit?
So I probably should say to begin with that we still think there is interest in direct lending in terms of private credit. So that it will be, it depends where in the direct lending market that you are investing as to the returns that you can get. And there's certainly areas where there is still a shortage of capital and this is some interesting returns to be made. The beyond direct lending, there's areas also, I think, in the asset-backed finance side. And so we talked a little bit about, there's some areas there that are less crowded, I would say. So direct lending, certainly, particularly the largest end of the direct lending market, has a lot of players there. A lot of private equity groups are then sort of getting that private credit lenders to compete against each other. That all weakens things for investors. But in terms of the, you've got on the asset-backed finance side, there's less areas where, well, there's less sort of lenders that are available in a lot of these markets. So you've got everything from, you know, aviation financing, you have equipment financing. So it's consumer insolvency, all areas where there's not as many lenders there. And so it's much easier, therefore, for kind of investors to be able to kind of get better returns, more persistent returns, and where sort of more specialized areas of the market. So these are certainly areas that we're all kind of focused on going forward. Distressed also, I think, is something that hasn't been, you know, has been a challenging area of distress special situations, have been a challenging area in recent years. For a long time it's been. So that's something
that, a lot of distress.
Exactly. Because there's not been a lot of distress. And so that's certainly something that, you know, we expect interest rate to stay higher for longer. We certainly expect that there'll be more to do in those areas. So even if you don't see companies going into full bankruptcy, you'll see them sort of trying to do different types of borrowing to be able to kind of keep themselves tided over. And so that will also present opportunities for more specialized private credit lenders to come in.
Lynette, thank you so much for joining us on Alternative Realities and giving our audience a deep dive into private credit and the industry's outlook in today's market environment.
Thank you. Thanks, Aaron.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only, based on assumptions in current market conditions, and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.